Welcome to Lexis, the podcast all about language and linguistics. I'm Lisa Casey.
I'm Jackie Glancy.
I'm Dan Clayton.
And I'm Jill Lavender.
Okay, so we're delighted to be joined on this episode of Lexis by Dr. Heidi Coulthart, who is a lecturer in English language and linguistics at the University of Kent. So welcome, Heidi. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Hello, Heidi. Just wanted to start off by saying that I was quite interested to read how you arrived at working in this field. And, you know, because you seem to have a rich experience of lots of other areas of work. Can you trace for us how your interest developed?
Okay. My main reason for sort of being here is to talk about the language of gaming. And video gaming is sort of has been a passion of mine. My dad bought me a Sinclair Spectrum when I was a kid. And so I really enjoyed that until I was sort of into my teens and then obviously got more interested in other things. I ended up actually going and studying history at university for the first time round. And also as part of that degree, I did a joint honours and trained as a primary school teacher. I was attracted by the history side of things, but also I really liked the idea that I thought naively that being a primary school teacher would mean that I would get to spend quite a lot of time playing in the sand and playing essentially and sort of being creative and having fun. So I did that for some years and then I left full-time teaching in schools when I got married to a farmer and started working on the family farm. We used to get the Farmers Weekly magazine arrive every week, as most farming families do in the UK. And I thought, well, you know, there's far too many men writing in this. And it doesn't really reflect the fact that there are an awful lot of women in farming. So I emailed the then editor and said, you need women writing for you. I'm a woman. I'm on a farm. I can write you some articles. And they came back to me and said, you're right. So send us something. And I did. They published it. And then once it came out, they got in contact with me and said, would you like to write a column for us? I got my first column in a national magazine.
Yeah.
Just off the back of sheer cheek. And that was then how my freelance journalism career started. I had also decided to, along the way, to go back to education. I went and did a fine art degree because I loved art and, you know, it sort of goes back to the primary school thing of, you know, I really enjoyed spending time playing in the sand and painting. So I did that. I did a part-time fine art degree and the whole way through that degree, the thing that I was really interested in was narrative, fascinated by how story worked. And in fact, even when I did my first degree and was a primary school teacher, I was just fascinated by the way that stories conveyed so much more than what they just appear to convey on the surface. So that, as I say, was a common thread throughout the whole of my fine art degree. And I ended up making short films and lots of sort of installations related to story. When I started that, I needed some way to fund it. So, you know, I've written for a number of different publications.
Mm.
It's a great job, but really the pay isn't regular. So I was also contacted by an old friend of mine. She contacted me and asked if I would be interested in or knew anyone who would be able to go and teach at a local university, not Kent where I am now, but another local university where they needed somebody to go and teach creative writing. And that sort of started the next career of being an academic. So I started doing a PhD about digital narratives,
right,
and then very quickly realized that I had to take into consideration video games as digital literature. That reminded me how much I loved playing on the Spectrum and then subsequently the Amiga. But now I'm an absolutely committed PC gamer. And yeah, that sort of then changed my PhD into looking specifically at walking sims and how narrative works in video games.
Mm.
And that's part of what I teach now. I still teach some of the journalism stuff too.
So just going back to the sort of idea of games as a thing, even before we're kind of thinking about video games, how would you define what we actually mean by a game?
So I'm inclined to actually rely upon the definition that Katie Zahlen and Eric Zimmerman give in their book, The Rules of Play.
Right.
Which is a really, really good book. But they talk about it being a system. And it's a system where players engage in an artificial conflict. So that idea of it being a conflict, but it's artificial.
Yeah.
And it's defined by rules. So you have to have conflict, you have to have rules, and then you have to have a quantifiable outcome. So it's those three things that I think are really important. And it doesn't matter whether that's a video game or a football game or even playing somebody playing something like rock, paper, scissors.
Mm, right. So
that's very, very simple then.
I'm going to give you some names of games that I think might be games. I'm going to need to tell me if they're actually games or not then.
Okay.
To definitely.
I'll try.
The National Lottery.
Yeah, game.
Bingo.
Game.
Risk.
Game.
Dungeons and Dragons.
In theory, game, but it sort of depends how long you keep playing for. Because
yeah, because it's a set outcome.
Yeah. A campaign can go on forever, but in theory, yeah, a game.
Pokemon Go?
Yeah, a game because there is, again, an outcome.
Yeah. Escape rooms?
Yes, definitely game. Yeah.
Right. And then Fortnite?
Fortnite game.
Okay. So they fit fairly well, don't they, into that categorization?
Yeah.
So if we're thinking a little bit about the kind of language dimension to gaming. You kind of talked a bit about the sort of narrative thing that drove your interest initially.
Yeah.
But what other things is kind of language doing within games?
So, I mean, particularly thinking about not just video games, pretty much any games, because you can put this in sports games as well. So generally you have sort of three layers that are going on. So you have the language that's actually used within the game, as part of the game.
Right.
So, you know, blowing a whistle, let's start, you know, foul, or you player one, you know, you're ready, or, you know, you're standing in the middle of a field, turn left or whatever.
Yeah.
So you have that language that's actually within the game. You then have the language that emerges from the players whilst they're playing.
Yeah.
So whether that's players on a pitch shouting to each other, you know, or whether it's people playing Fortnite or Call of Duty or whatever, when they've got headphones on and, you know, oh, look behind you, that sort of thing. So you get, or even when you're playing on your own and you're shouting at the screen, you know, which some of us do a lot.
That's me.
You have those expressions that come out that, again, are absolutely tied into the game, but they are emerging from your gameplay. And then you have another type of language or another sort of area of language that comes out generally after the game. And that's the thing that I'm really interested in, because it shows so much of what's going on in our brains, is when people go online in particular, and rather like book groups where people get together and talk about, oh, I really enjoyed it when this happened.
Yeah.
You can see on game forums, so whether it's on Steam or whether it's on Reddit or wherever, where people are going and talking about, I did this or the character did that.
Right.
And they talk about their particular experience. And it's not just, you know, particularly on those forums, you'll get a lot of the threads will be about people saying, oh, I got stuck here. How do I get past that bit?
Yeah.
But there will also be people just really discussing things and saying, well, what did you think about that bit? You know, why does that happen? And why does this work like this? And, you know, and where can you find that element? And so, yeah, there is another dimension then that goes on. And I say I'm particularly interested in that because of what it tells us about what happens to our brains whilst we're actually playing.
And the kind of pleasures and experiences that we gain from them.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And we like to relive that in the same way that we do when we've watched a film or when we've read a book. We like to share it with people and say, yeah, I really like the bit when.
And I guess that's the sort of fandom around it, is it?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And of course, we then get that added when people start to write fan fiction, which we're inclined to think just comes out of films and novels, but actually there is a growing amount of fan fiction around video games too. One of the things that I'm looking at the moment is the stories that people write around their Sims.
Yeah.
And it's hilarious. Love it.
Just sort of taking a step back into the kind of language within the game. So if you're thinking about, say, I guess this is like video games, but also maybe kind of role-playing games before the video era, that kind of world building and sort of character creation, and then the creation of the narrative, what sort of language elements do you think sort of feed into those? I mean, thinking from the sort of perspective that, you know, students at A-level are thinking about things like vocabulary, syntax, discourse structure, that kind of stuff. What kind of linguistic parts are there to that kind of language?
So what you're generally seeing is a certain element of, or a certain amount of instructional language that you actually need to understand what to do. So this is even the stuff that comes up on screen, particularly in a lot of the sort of role-playing games, but also first-person shooters that will just sort of have the very first part that's like a tutorial. It will explain, you know, you need to press this button to do this action and so on. So you get a lot of that, a lot of a very straightforward instruction language. So that's one element that is, as I say, just very simple, straightforward, very heavy on verbs and so on.
Yeah.
And then you will start to get some of the character building and the world building elements. But what happens is, again, very dependent upon the title, with character of the game, the character building elements and will be, as I say, very dependent on the title. So some games encourage players, and in fact, this helps the player with their immersion into the game and helps their interaction into the game by encouraging them to actually create their character. And that will then be, you know, all of those screens that you get perhaps at the very beginning where you can actually change how your character looks. So, for instance, last year I spent probably far too much time playing Red Dead Redemption 2 online. So I had a character on there was almost identical to me. But that actually plays a very fundamental role for the player, because it means that shift that you do, and this is absolutely something that I look at sort of within linguistics, this deictic shift. So that whole notion of deixis and of where we cognitively position ourselves, you know, we move in our minds cognitively. We move from sitting on the sofa or wherever in front of the screen, and we're helped in that shift to move into the screen and into the game and to be immersed in the game, partly by creating characters that either look like us or at least that we feel that we've got some agency over. And it's more than agency of just, I'm getting the character to move around the screen. It's, you know, oh, I've been able to choose their clothes, change their hair color, make them look like myself or a version of me that maybe isn't the same species or the same gender or whatever, but just, you know, yeah, that is still a version of me that perhaps would like to be 10 foot tall and, I don't know, you know, a mouse or a cat or whatever. So there's that going on. So that really helps to build character. And of course, yes, you've got alongside that the type of language that will be there within the game. The language that the characters use, that's, of course, controlled by the developers and the managers. Even if you're given a bit of choice, you might be given a choice between, you know, answering rudely or answering politely and so on. But it's still very much their creation. So you can have perhaps some control over the way it looks. And then you've got within game the sort of language that you see around the world building. And a lot of that will, again, be very dependent upon game genre. So, of course, you know, if you've got something that's role playing, you're more likely to see, I don't know, things like, well, swords and sorcery and elves and so on. Or in the case of Red Dead Redemption, horses.
Yeah.
You know, all of that
cowboy
stuff. So, yeah, exactly. Howdy, partner.
Or a deer that you can't actually shoot with a bow for the first hour of the game.
Yeah. And so many of that, you know. And if you, when you start playing online with Red Dead, you know, you may as well just paint a target on your character's back. because everybody comes along and they shoot you. And yeah, it can be a bit soul destroying at times.
It can. I think I was reading something recently that was suggesting good games for the over 50s to play. And it's basically saying don't do first person shooters because young people will have much better reactions.
Yeah.
Although I did, my biggest triumph was probably killing an 8-year-old called Waste Man Killer on PUBG one Christmas. I'm really proud to say that I probably ruined this child's Christmas.
Well,
killed my old man.
If they're there playing the game. Have you seen, there is a video, and I've actually given this to students to analyze. There is a video on YouTube, and I can't remember. It's one of the games websites. It's American, and they have given Grand Theft 5 to a group of seniors. And it's brilliant. I mean, it's brilliant from the sort of the point of view of seeing that shift. They start off by, oh, yes, I've heard of this TV program. And, you know, and it's like, what do you mean? You know, yes. There's no idea at all. And then they start sort of playing and, you know, they can't even get the car out of the car park. They're just, you know, and they're passing really sort of off-color remarks about the character.
Yeah.
He's not very nice and so on. And then after about 20 minutes or so, and they've got a reasonable grasp of the controls, they stop saying he is doing this and he's doing that. And they start saying things like, oh, wow, I found some guns. And one, there's a woman in there and she obviously lives in California. And there's one part that you can sort of go down to, I think it's like supposed to be the Santa Monica Pier.
Mm.
And she says, oh, this is exactly as it is. And she in GTA goes on the roller coaster. You know, so there's her character going on the roller coaster. And again, it's not her saying he's on there or yeah. He's having a good time. It's her doing it. And then as the roller coaster is going, she's sitting there going, whoa,
the immersion.
Yeah, that immersion. And you can absolutely track from what they say. You can see where the shift happens and where they go from being, I'm watching this stuff happening on screen to I'm on screen.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's really fascinating to see and to unpick.
I'm kind of feeling a bit seen here. I mean, I think as a total games, well, not a total games virgin. I have played, you know, Cluedo in my youth a long time ago, but certainly not like either of you. I don't know anything about it, so I'm fascinated. So when we talk about game studies, is that a huge umbrella term for all the things that you said earlier, you know, the three elements that make what we talk of as a game, conflict, rules, and an outcome? Is that an umbrella term for all sorts of games, or are we talking about something wider?
It tends to be, I mean, historically, there's been a bit of an argument that actually didn't really exist, but there was this idea that there was an argument going on between ludologists.
Oh,
who just look at game studies, and obviously that's then related to maths and things like probability and so on. Mm-hmm. And then there's narratologists, and they're people like me who are really interested in how narrative works. But the fact is that, you know, in game studies, those two aspects really sort of come together. And, you know, the realization that in so many video games now, and not even just video games, we're seeing the effects in TV and film as well, and in books too. You know, we see that these ideas of sort of playfulness are really becoming more and more noticeable and accepted. And, you know, even things like, you know, a few years ago, if you said that you were interested in role-playing games, you know, whether it was like, you know, LARPing, live-action role-playing games in the real world, or whether it's sort of online, you know, people sort of realizing that, oh, there's this a huge story to do with that, you know, and that's not something that just weird people do, you know, but actually normal people, you know, everybody can take part in. And, you know, that's not that far removed from, you know, things like historical reenactment and, you know, people really thoroughly enjoying reading or watching something like, you know, Jane Austen, you know. So it all of those things do sort of come together. And we could say that it's within game studies, but I think that as much as we would love to have a world where it was very much a case of, oh, yes, it's okay to study games and literature and stories. Actually, we are still at a point where, you know, within schools and academia and so everywhere, things are still very much siloed. As much as we like to be sort of interdisciplinary and sort of do bits from here and, you know, yes, look at certain elements of game and other elements of story, it does get a bit siloed off. And, oh, you look at literature or you look at video games. But in actual fact, they do cross over, and they should cross over, because they're just different ways of telling a story.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, they're looking at identities, they're looking at power and narrative, as you've said, and all of these things thread together.
Yeah.
And that's what I think I would be really fascinated by.
Maybe the multimodality of it all as well.
Yes.
It just sounds, that's fascinating, isn't it? And language is so multimodal.
Yeah.
I mean, it always has been multimodal to an extent, hasn't it? But the kind of potential we've now got for all of this just feels like it's ripe for analysis.
Absolutely. And increasingly it is. You know, there are more and more people talking about the elements within sort of the digital world with multimodality. And it's something that, you know, since we've had this digital revolution, increasingly it's becoming more pervasive across certainly all of the arts and humanities, but, you know, also through the sciences too. Mm-hmm. You know, it is that idea that we can look at our world through so many different lenses and through these different modes. And we should be doing that, because that's, you know, the totality at the moment of the human experience. So, I definitely approve of multimodality.
So if we put you on the spot then, Heidi, and said, can you pick two or three of your favourite games and tell us what linguistic dimensions are of particular interest in those? Which ones would you go for?
So I thought about this, and I've written a list for myself.
Yay.
So I would say that one of my favorite games at the moment, anyway, this shift, it's a bit like when somebody says to you, what's your favorite book? You know, and it, well, this week, but yeah, certainly for the last few years, one of my favorites is Dear Esther, which is a walking sim from the Chinese Room. And it's written by Dan Pinchbeck, who is he's a British academic. And it's a game that has become reasonably well known because it's very beautiful to look at. And also it has an amazing soundtrack by Jessica Curry. So that's a walking sim. It's not really a game, but you come to it on a gaming platform. So it's easy shorthand to call it a game. So there's that one. It's, as I say, it's beautiful. It's more like a short story, an interactive short story. But the interaction is simply moving around an island and then trying to figure out what on earth is going on. So it's quite dark, you know, because it deals with a man who has lost his wife. And so there's an awful lot about loss and death and so on. But it's beautiful, and the soundtrack is gorgeous. So that's one of my favourites, because it's hugely atmospheric and just lovely. And then certainly Grand Theft Auto, but not particularly for playing it, but really for things like watching other people play it.
Yeah.
But also I found, you know, my own experience, Grand Theft has been far more fun to play with a group of people and for us each to take a turn, rather than I'm going to go and do this game and sort of play it from beginning to end. I remember, I think the first time I played it, the first thing I somehow managed to find an ice cream van in the park, and I stole that, because of course that's the point. And I turned on the bells and the tune and just drove over people from the park. So I really liked that.
Innocent fun.
it's so transgressive in nature. And I think that's one of the things that is one of the reasons why Grand Theft has been so popular, is because people who are perfectly law-abiding and would never dream of doing anything like that in the real world, you get the opportunity to play that out.
There's definitely been an element of controversy about it, though, hasn't there, I think, with GTA, because I think there's been quite a lot of discussion around the fact that it is so gritty and real, that some of the language in there is, you know, particularly kind of racial epithets and things like that, which are used with kind of gay abandon.
Are,
you know, are they appropriate to be used in a game? You know, are they appropriating certain cultural norms of, you know, other ethnic groups? And using them for comedy. There's an element of, you know, that there's a problem in there, isn't there, as
yeah,
well?
Yeah, absolutely. And also that's one of the reasons why I like it, is because there's that it is incredibly problematic. And yes, there is a hugely problematic nature of the language that's used, the treatment of various different groups in there. You know, I think that makes for a strangely very rich experience, because again, it's totally transgressive. And I think there are times when, if only to sort of try it on to see how it feels in a very safely controlled setting, like a game, where you can actually see, well, you know, what would it feel like if I said something like this to someone that I would never, ever dream of doing, saying, or even thinking about in the real world? But what if I can be that type of character for a brief moment, or, you know, an hour or 2 hours or whatever?
Yeah.
And I think that there is actually something quite healthy in that, of that opportunity to be transgressive and to, as I say, in a very limited way.
Yeah.
And I think that that's something we're going to see in the future, particularly with VR headsets, and hopefully one day a proper holodeck. You know, we'll get to really be transgressive and not do it in the real world, but it's get it all out of our system.
Yes.
But my current favourite that I'm playing, again, far too much, I mean, literally, when I get home from work, it's a case of, no, I don't watch very much TV. I will spend maybe an hour or more playing The Sims. But The Sims 2 has to be number 2. So it's nearly 20 years old, but there is a huge online community. And there's a huge number of modifications that you can download.
Yeah.
And so the modding community is vast. And because essentially it's like playing with dolls and a doll's house, people create these amazing stories and, you know, have various different things happening with, you know, there's a base set of characters and you can start with them. You can create your own, homes if you want to, and so on. But it's hugely entertaining because you are coming up with these narratives that are often quite bizarre, and people then write about them. And certainly there's still a lot of the writing has disappeared over the years. I mean, I sort of got into this quite a lot, I suppose, about 15, 20 years ago. When it first came out, I was a big fan. A lot of them were in places like LiveJournal, and people no longer use LiveJournal. You know,
right,
they've disappeared, you know, with the whole sort of ephemerality of the internet, sadly. But at the moment, there are still a number of novel length stories that people have got of their sim play. And, you know, they've changed just the very sort of pared down actual gameplay, and they've created whole dialogues and setting and, you know, proper novels. And they can still be found in places like Archive of Our Own, which of course is where fan fiction has its home.
Right.
So,
yeah.
And I'm looking at that actually for research at the moment. And it means I get to play The Sims again.
I suppose it's that attraction of creating your own kind of light narrative, isn't it?
Completely. Yeah. Yeah. And that appeals to the writer in me. There's a lot of that sort of stuff going on that means it's a great deal of fun, but I'm really interested in how other people also write about that. So it's a great source of stories, and that is just really entertaining, as well as seeing how people have made their Sims look in particular ways, how they've got particular outfits and different, you know, they've made their homes look amazing. And you can then go and download all of that stuff and make yours look amazing. So there's sort of a lot of elements there of, as I say, things like virtual dollhouses.
Mm.
So it's more of a toy than a game, which I think is how it was originally pitched when the game first came out, as a toy.
Yeah.
And it is, because you do keep coming back to it.
So moving from that sort of richness of narrative and creating characters to the sort of some of the stuff that many of our students like to look at is like the kind of language used during gaming. So there's lots of students at A-level have done investigations where they look at how people use language when they're competing online, you know, like maybe like in COD or FIFA.
Yeah.
And that kind of, you know, like you say, with the headsets on, talking to each other, at each other, competing. What would you say are the sort of interesting sort of linguistic dimensions around that kind of language use online?
I think, well, one of the things I particularly find interesting about that is this idea of where the player has positioned themselves.
Right.
Mm. So it's where you have, say, you know, a group campaign. So you've maybe got, you know, a cooperative of perhaps four or five players, and they will be watching out, particularly with something like COD. And they'll be watching out from their own different viewpoint. And they'll be saying things to each other like, look behind, you know, watch behind you. Somebody's coming up. So it's that thing that they're using, deictic language, positional language.
Yeah.
So look behind you. But they, of course, don't mean look behind in the real world. Because if they looked behind themselves, they'd probably see their mum or, you know, pictures on the wall or whatever. But in fact, what they're talking about is this virtual world. So what we're seeing there is this blending of these different worlds that the human brain is able to hold. Those players never lose sight of the fact that they are in the real world. You know, they know that they are sitting at home on their bed or whatever. But they are also present in this virtual world on screen. And they've also then got this other rather nebulous world where they're with their friends online. And, you know, that is sort of, it's playing out on screen, but what they're seeing isn't a true reflection of how their friends look. And certainly this was something that during lockdown, and if, you know, if people have been able to get hold of recordings of gameplay, particularly with teenagers and sort of younger kids who were sort of any games, even if it was things like Minecraft, if they're playing something like that, you know, doing that cooperatively during lockdown, I know from listening to my own sons, they'd put on the headset and they would go and play Fortnite or COD or something like that. And they would be having a conversation with their mates. They would actually be socializing,
yeah,
you know, but they're doing it whilst they're playing this game. So
right,
you get a number of different things going on. So you get some language that's specifically about the game. You know, look out behind you. Oh, you know, there's a cache of weapons round the corner. You know, what are you doing? Watch out. You know, those sorts of things. But you would also be getting bits and pieces of them using purely social language of actually the same thing that they would be doing if they were, say, playing a game in the playground. You know, they would sort of be teasing each other, you know, they would be calling each other by, you know, sort of nicknames or whatever.
Yeah.
And very much all of those, yeah, that sort of social language that we use as well. So that's, I think, really interesting that you can see this being sort of absolutely carried out, even though it's in a virtual space. You've got the same type of exchanges that happen with people, human beings, regardless of their age, wherever they are. All of that happens when you've got on a headset and you're playing cooperatively, as well as, you know, if you're sitting, I don't know, if you've got a group of, and it tends to be older people, playing, you know, Crown Green bowling. It's the same thing.
Yes.
Yeah. Absolutely. Same type of language. And it's just that, you know, we've now got this medium of video games that allows all of this additional sort of social language and social interaction to happen.
I guess it's a kind of modern day online equivalent of playing pool down the pub, isn't it?
Exactly that. Yes, exactly that. And, you know, people do sort of, you know, every so often the media sort of goes off on one and says, oh, this is terrible. You know, children don't play outside anymore. They don't play in the streets anymore. And sort of neglect to you know, mention the fact that, well, so many playgrounds and so many playing fields have gone. And also we have such a big reliance upon vehicles that the roads are not safe to do that anymore. But that still, that socialization is still happening. Just doing it online. They're talking to each other.
Yeah, I had a student who did a really good study on, well, looking at a group of people playing a game or having played a game, I can't quite remember, and at the concept of experience and versus being a newbie,
yeah,
and the idea that some people, there was a sort of in-group, out-group thing going down with some people where they used a lot of specific terminology in order to appear experienced and make somebody feel uncomfortable and naive perhaps, And then other people were being very helpful and advising and saying, well, what you want to do is get this first and do that move first. And then they would be arguing with each other as experts. No, 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 don't tell him to do that because this will happen. And just the dynamics within that group and how they were managing the social power and hierarchy and making bids for being more powerful is absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, and exactly what you see in the real world. And, you know, no difference at all. Just the fact that we've now got this additional medium that we can use, as much as, you know, the lockdowns and so on. And of course, you know, it was a very dark period for everyone. But those fundamentals of socialization for an awful lot of people carried on just in a different setting, because it's fundamental to our experience of being human.
Okay, then, Heidi, what's your favorite book about language?
Fiction would be Ridley Walker by Russell Hoban, because it's written in a very strange version of English set far in the future. And nonfiction would have to be Mary Law Ryan's book, Narrative as Virtual Reality, but book two.
What's your favourite linguistic fact or idea?
The fact that we make and understand our entire world through metaphor. I love that. The fact that everything, and yes, I am a big Star Trek fan, and yes, I have seen the Darmok episode, but just that whole idea that we constantly use metaphors and that, you know, depending on the context, we'll understand it or have no idea what somebody's talking about. Mm. So yeah, love that.
Perfect. And lastly, what one bit of advice would you give a budding linguist?
Read everything and anything. And yeah, keep up with popular culture. Watch things, keep asking questions, read, watch, listen, and ask lots and lots of questions.
Brilliant. Excellent advice.
Thanks very much, Heidi.
Fabulous.
That's great.
You're very welcome.
Okay, so in today's Lang in the News, we are doing a little bit of a deep dive into Oxfam's 92-page publication of advice and guidance about ways to use language, ways that are more gender neutral, more inclusive. It came out in sort of the middle of March of this year, 2023, and almost immediately lots and lots of responses from mainstream news publications, but also some slightly smaller news outlets as well. We thought that this was a really lovely story because it covers so many things that are of interest to us as people more interested in looking at language closely. So yeah. Dan, do you want to start off with saying the sorts of things that Oxfam gave guidance on in the report?
Yeah. So, I mean, as most people are probably aware, Oxfam is a charity and they do a lot of work around the world. There's been a kind of whole background to this. In some of the NGOs who work around the world have been criticised for, I guess, sort of colonial mindsets and maybe kind of ways in which they impose a particular kind of vision of the world on people. But also there's been a number of different cases of some NGOs being kind of involved in sort of exploitation and abuse. But I mean, that's not to take away from the fact that loads of these charities do loads of amazing work and help a lot of people all over the place. Now, Oxfam produced what they called an inclusive language guide, as Lisa said, 92 pages. And they said in here that in the past, Oxfam and our peers in the sector have been guilty of white saviour narratives, with the words we use reinforcing stereotypes about the people we work to support. This was wrong, and we're learning from decolonial activists to change that. Making conscious choices in language can reframe issues, rewrite tired stories, challenge problematic ideas, and build a radically better future, based on a survivor-centered, intersectional, anti-racist and feminist vision of equality, which all sounds quite good to me.
I can hear the right-wing press screaming from the outset.
I mean, you can hear that, and you can also hear that they maybe swallowed a kind of intersectional dictionary as well. But you can kind of see where this is going. But it's interesting that the whole guide itself is about language and the importance of language, and then lots of the stories that we'll focus on in the sort of backlash to it and the commentary on it are also about language as well. And we can look at the sort of language used in some of those. Mm. They covered stuff around language to do with ability and disability, how different parts of the world might be described. So, you know, they prefer things like global majority, global minority, rather than the West or, you know, third world or developing countries. They talk about things around sexuality and gender, and they talk about things to do with, I think, sort of parenthood. And that's really where some of the most extreme reactions
came. Vociferous, you could say. Mm. Before we get into the parenthood thing specifically, I think it's worth saying we spend quite a lot of time on this podcast talking about how the world would be better if people thought more about language. And I think we agreed that when we read sort of the Oxfam guidance, it is exactly what we would want a public-facing institution to do. There's a really lovely paragraph that I'm going to quote from directly, where they basically frame the whole of the narrative as, this is meant to encourage thought. Mm. It's not meant to be restrictive. I'm just going to read a little bit. These principles and language guidelines are designed to prompt thought when using language. They are not set rules, should not be viewed as restrictions. They are intended to complement existing messaging frameworks and positionings. We recognize that language is context and audience specific and shifts between time and place. We would encourage you to think about what works best for your purpose. I mean, to me, that sounds like it's been written by a linguist. Even the use of the word positionings, for example, suggests, you know, a really, really careful and thoughtful acknowledgement that language is context specific. And they've literally said it shifts according to time and place. You know, we couldn't ask for more thoughtful sort of guidelines from a linguistic point of view. But as you've said, there are elements of some of the wordings themselves that seem to have got a lot of people's backs up, but also that other people think are great.
Yeah.
So should we have a look at those in a bit more detail?
Yeah. So one of the angles, as we sort of alluded to earlier, that was picked up on in some of the responses was around parenting and parenthood. Now, some of this was done, I think, in kind of rather bad faith with rather selective quotation and a complete dismissal of any kind of surrounding context.
Yeah, I think we'll need to screenshot as well and put in the show notes the actual guidance from Oxfam, which graphologically does some quite nice work with sort of highlighting the words that they want. So it's got a big sort of green tick next to parent and parenthood, and them talking about how parent is more inclusive if you are unsure about how people want to be referred to in a parenting situation. There's a big sort of green question mark that explains the rationale behind using parent if you are unclear about how somebody wants to be referred to. But it also specifically says in that section that if individual parents have a preference for a role or name, i.e. they want to be referred to as a mother or father, then of course we would respect their choice for that. And then there's a little green cross at the bottom that says we avoid, and then it says we avoid mother or father. We avoid assuming the adoption of gendered roles, particularly by transgender parents. And that's kind of how it's set out in the guidance.
Mm-mm. And of course, that does sound a little bit complicated. But then life's complicated, isn't it?
Yeah. And essentially what the articles that are sort of up in arms about it seem to ignore the context specific things and jumps straight to this idea that Oxfam is erasing mothers and fathers. And on one side of the debate, particularly erasing mothers specifically, which we might add is not what it says.
No.
It is not what it says. My inner teacher was fully coming out where I'm like, you've not read the text. You've not read what it actually says.
I think there were definitely some people who had read the text and decided to only quote bits of it. And I think, you know, that seemed particularly true in the case of what might be termed gender critical people who were quoted in the Mail piece, but also, you know, pushed this online quite a lot, including one person, Maya Forstatter, who said, how is ignoring and denigrating the world's mothers good for development? And I think realistically, that's not what the document does, is it?
No, it isn't. I mean, it isn't what it does. But really interestingly, kind of when you take the collective responses from sort of the national press, you've got the Mail that has an unsurprisingly sort of up in arms. I mean, they use literal exclamatives in their headlines, which is beyond parody, exclamation mark. And then you've got kind of the Telegraph, which goes with don't say mother or father as it could offend, Oxfam tells staff. And again, I'd like to reiterate that that's not what it says. but that is how the Telegraph has chosen to report it. But in more inclusive sort of supporting media outlets, like the Pink News, for example, which is written by sort of LGBTQ plus staff, we've got Oxfam hit back at critics of trans-inclusive guidance who claims it's erasing mums and dads. So there are more nuanced things out there, not just the kind of really angry, they're telling us not to use the words mum and dad anymore.
Yeah. And I mean, it's there's very much a kind of a sense with some of those headlines that it's part of a wider discourse we've seen before of inclusivity, exclusivity, culture wars kind of talking points. We talked about woke loads in previous episodes, and definitely it comes under that kind of banner where it's a kind of anti-woke backlash. There was an interesting piece in the New Statesman, which is kind of left of centre magazine, and that had the headline, "The furore over Oxfam's woke language guide misses the point." And well, there's a couple of things in this one that I thought were a little bit kind of reductive and simplistic, where they said they kind of frame it as a choice between what they term blustering bigotry or preening sanctimony. So I guess, you know, the idea that it's an either or position, that you can, you know, it's about either just ignoring people's feelings of being a bigot or being kind of condescending and sneering about people's language and telling them what to say. But there was some interesting stuff in that. So there's a paragraph from that I'm just going to quote from. They say in there, "Language is neither progressive nor regressive. It does not move along a line of continuous consensus-led improvement, nor will it wholly degrade into meaningless relativism. What it does do is change being the mess made by the passage of time. It evolves as nature evolves, scruffily, multifariously, and incrementally, its infinite variety matching that of the needs and circumstances of the people it serves."
I mean, that's kind of great, isn't it?
Yeah.
It sounds like the kind of thing David Crystal might have written, dare I say.
Yeah, definitely. And they go on to say, "This is what gives words their power to disrupt the status quo. They are radically demotic, belonging to everyone and no one. No top-down initiative or prescription, whether from a right-on NGO or a thundering middle-market tabloid, can rob them of that quality. No actor, however powerful, can control or shape the whole." And that's an interesting idea, isn't it, about prescriptivism, the idea of top-down prescriptivism. Because they certainly seem to be reading the Oxfam guidance as being a form of prescription. Some people have referred to this kind of stuff before, I guess, as like benign prescriptivism, the idea that it's got a kind of good motive behind it. But I suppose that's up for debate, isn't it? Whether you feel it's benign or not.
And we've talked about this before, is that it comes down often to kind of combating larger power structures that are in place, that if the grand narrative is of heterosexual parenting, where someone is a father and someone is a mother, and people take those roles and there are expectations of those roles, and that is the narrative, then that becomes social expectation, and people that sit outside of those feel minoritized or denigrated or whatever.
Yeah.
And that the argument is that in offering guidance, Oxfam is trying to counter this very, very powerful kind of status quo narrative about parenting. Mm. And I mean, I come back to their wording is that it's a suggestion and that it's guidance.
Exactly.
They literally say it's not meant to be a set of rules or prescriptive.
They are not set rules and should not be viewed as restrictions. Although that was, you know, I mean, they can say that and other people might read it another way. There's also the wider kind of discussion. I mean, the framing of all of this as part of a kind of wider discourse, if you like, around trans issues, around inclusivity, around gender and sex. It's not happening in a vacuum, is it?
No, and that's really telling, particularly in the Mail headline, which is really long. I might add, again, we'll screenshot it for you and put it in the show notes. So after saying, "Beyond parody, Oxfam's new 92-page inclusivity guide calls English, quote, the language of a colonizing nation." And then it goes on to talk about how they've, you know, told people to avoid the words mother and father. And that, exactly as you've said, draws on this sort of wider criticism of a supposedly left-wing narrative about language. And
maybe it is a left-wing narrative about language.
Just to refute the idea that Britain has colonized lots of other places. Factually inaccurate.
I mean, that is a crazy headline. Beyond parody. I mean,
beyond parody, exclamation mark, Dan. Yeah. Don't forget the exclamation mark.
The English is the language of a colonizing nation. Yes. There's no dispute, is there? How can that not be the case?
I wonder if there is an assumption that if we explode as angrily as we possibly can off the page at our readers, then they will feel a similar sense of outrage. Yeah, I don't know how you can refute that. But of course, what Oxfam has done is talked about why, has talked in the report about their rationale behind it, that they themselves as an institution have been accused of, you know, going out into other nations with this sort of white savior complex. And they've talked about the reasons behind the guidance that they're giving, which are actually fairly reasonable as far as language guidance and guidelines go.
Very much. I mean, I'd urge anyone to actually have a look at the document itself. I mean, there's some really clear discussion in there about why they're choosing certain terms, why they think certain ones are better than others.
But also framed by an assertion that it is context specific. So if these terms don't work in a particular situation, then, you know, don't use them.
Yeah,
that's okay.
And a lot of the criticism directed at them is saying, well, just get on with your charity work. Stop going on about all this woke language. And part of the point they're trying to make in the document is that we have to be thoughtful about the work we do. And language is part of the work we do. It's a bit rich coming from people sort of sitting on the sidelines, sniping at them, isn't it? When actually Oxfam is doing some very important work around the globe.
But it's interesting that it doesn't acknowledge its own role in perpetuating what could be seen as quite damaging ideas, for example. So if people want to use mother or father, that is absolutely fine. But we would argue that there's nothing wrong with, in situations where you don't know, using parent instead. In the same way that in situations that you do know that someone wants to be referred to as a mother or a father, then that's okay as well. And finding some space for both to be okay.
Yeah, so as well as broadly sort of inclusive language guidance, there's also been lots of discussion around pronouns, which I suppose is part of that bigger picture. There's been a lot of discussion around whether we can have gender neutral pronouns, around new pronouns that can be created, or even if older ones can do the job. And there's also been quite a lot of kickback in the US and UK, particularly around people putting forward their preferred pronouns. So, you know, for example, in their Twitter profile, saying, you know, my pronouns are he, him, and others mocking them by saying, well, my preferred pronouns are king and lord, which are nouns, not pronouns. And Dennis Barron, who's a linguist in the US, has a nice little kind of series of tweets about this, but he's also written a really good book called What's Your Pronoun Beyond He and She, which looks at the history of pronouns in English, attempts to create new ones, attempts to make he generic or she generic, the role of they as well. And there's also another nice little clip on Twitter of Oluyemi Olorin talking about how gender inclusive language doesn't have to harm or diminish womanhood, as she puts it. We'll include a link to that in the show notes. And that's a nice little two and a half minute clip of her explaining her position on that, and around avoiding kind of giving in to sort of what she terms right-wing talking points and instead thinking about inclusivity as a broader principle.
Yeah, we'll put all of the links and screenshots in the show notes, and do give Dennis Barron a follow on Twitter, because his stuff on pronouns is really, really nice little snippets, really good for looking at with students as well as a starter, or for opening up a conversation about grammar, pronouns, and then broader discourses around them.